The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2021 issue. We begin with our cover story, How to Save Planet Earth. Your individual behavior won't fix climate change. Five experts share more meaningful ways to think green. Have you ever held a product in your hands and considered the existential weight of your purchase? Beyond each price tag hides a ripple effect. It expands from soil to waterways, grocery aisles to kitchen plates, factories to fulfillment centers, and mail slots to landfills. This global impact has become less hidden in the past decade, and ignoring the people downstream from us has grown increasingly difficult. We're more aware than ever of the mark our consumption leaves on planet Earth, which now sustains nearly 8 billion people. Somehow, humans are still pumping more than 30 gigatons of carbon dioxide per year into the atmosphere, despite the mountain of evidence that carbon dioxide is the top contributor to greenhouse gases causing global warming. Similar conundrums apply to use of plastics and consumption of meat and other goods. We know we need to do better, but we feel helpless and overwhelmed. Let's call this the ecostential crisis. It applies on a deeply personal level for most environmentally aware humans and on a global scale. Climate journalist and author Tatiana Schlossberg says even a simple trip to the supermarket can feel paralyzing in 2021. I want to buy the local thing, but it's not organic, or maybe it's in a plastic box, she says. In her 2019 book, Inconspicuous Consumption, she ventures way beyond the store aisle and into the web of less apparent ways that humans are damaging Earth. For example, your internet use is tied to extensive carbon emissions and energy consumption. The solution to this problem, however, is not for you to stop using the internet, according to Schlossberg and a host of other climate experts. The world is more complicated than that. In fact, being a good citizen on planet Earth has never been more complicated. On your own journey with climate concerns, you've likely asked or agonized over this question, what should I do? It's easy to get lost in the blizzard of supposed answers swirling around social media, the latest data sets and eco-friendly marketing campaigns. So we took this question of five people who have immersed their careers, research, and writing in the realities of climate science. One of their most consistent insights may surprise you. Consumer responsibility and guilt-ridden behavior modification misses the mark. One of the major failings of the environmental movement is having everyone focus on these small things that anyone can do, says Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, a marine biologist and co-host of the podcast, How to Save a Planet. That doesn't mean you're off the hook. There are just more meaningful and long-lasting ways to spend your energy in the climate fight. Most of them involve organization and collective action. Individuals join together collectively have far more power changing the system than they can as individuals, says Anthony Lazarowitz, director of the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. He and many researchers who have run the numbers say even the most valiant voluntary lifestyle modifications, going vegan, refusing to fly, or investing in green energy for your home, fall far short of the change we need. These experts propose other key steps that every human can take towards a better future. But first, you must understand some of the facts and myths on the current playing field. Climate journalist and author David Wallace Wells puts the climate reality in stark terms. We need to get from about 40 gigatons a year of carbon emissions to zero in the next few decades if we want to stabilize the planet's climate below what's been called a catastrophic level of warming, Wallace Wells says. His recent book, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming, paints a bleak, evidence-based picture of the near future on Earth. The book shot to number one on the New York Times bestseller list in 2019. His take, and that of his peers, is that voluntarily shaving back your personal carbon output by some percentage, or buying actual carbon offset credits while you keep using fossil fuels, is a less significant fight. More specifically, it's the fight that fossil fuel companies told customers to take on. It's a diversion. It's an extremely successful PR campaign to make us all feel terrible about our individual decisions and not actually focus on changing the fact that we have a fossil fuel-based economy, Johnson says. As a prime example, three of our experts pointed to the history of the carbon footprint, a tool that tells you or your business how much pollution you're creating. The fossil fuel industry, particularly British Petroleum, or BP, pushed this concept onto the masses in a hugely successful marketing effort roughly 20 years ago. Rather than try to defend its crude oil, petroleum, and other fossil fuel products, which the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency now identifies as the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions, the industry handed its customers a method to feel bad about their consumption. Meanwhile, BP ranks sixth on the list of the world's top contributors of carbon dioxide and methane, according to 2017 data from the Climate Accountability Institute. In just 20 energy companies are responsible for 35% of these pollutants worldwide. Another campaign that began with fossil fuel companies, the modern approach to recycling that has been integrated across the U.S. for decades, despite persistent criticism and concerns about the broken model. Essentially, the petroleum-reliant plastics industry framed recycling as a fix, while continuing to create new plastics with petroleum, natural gas, and their byproducts, and profiting off the business. Meanwhile, only a fraction of what you responsibly toss in the proper bin gets recycled. It's totally bogus, Laserwitz says. As long as you and I are left on the hook for this, the companies are free. In a major NPR and PBS Frontline investigation in 2020, journalist Laura Sullivan wrote, "The industry sold the public on an idea they knew wouldn't work, all while making billions of dollars selling the world new plastic." With this broader understanding of the crisis at hand, consumers can make informed and deliberate actions to shift our culture at large, as if our climate depends on it. Wallace Wells says this doesn't cancel out living your personal values with lifestyle and purchasing decisions. Sure, eat less meat, get rid of your petroleum-guzzling vehicle, or boycott plastics. Those things generally carry a degree of benefit to the government, to the environment. But the urgent priority is to change the massive industries, policies, and fuel source at the root. Part of the challenge with the environmental movement is the staggering list of things we need to change. Agricultural practices, transportation systems, and power grids, to name a few. There's no singular environmental cause that everyone should be tackling in their personal life. Instead, try moving beyond the paralyzing view of everything that needs fixed. Pick something specific in your life. The question is not what is the one thing everyone can do, but what is the special thing that each one of us can contribute, Johnson says. Your specific interests and skill sets should guide you, and you can typically incorporate your effort where you are already working, living, or playing. One recent example played out after Johnson attended a star-studded climate protest in Washington, D.C., with her friend Boris Kentov, a senior vice president and a financial planning firm. Feeling energized and motivated after the event, Boris asked whether he could attend another march. Johnson redirected him. "I told him, 'No, Boris, you're a finance executive. Go back to work and fix your company.'" In the fall of 2020, Kentov helped launch socially responsible and environmentally friendly investment portfolios at Betterment. This mindset applies to everyone, whether you're a line cook, maintenance employee, pastor, rural farmer, or corporate executive. Your specific work setting and social circles would benefit on a large scale from your individual passion and example. It just requires some initiative. And that's one of the best investments of your energy and time. What are you good at? And how can you use those skills, resources, and spheres of influence? Johnson says. The specific answers to your questions will identify what she calls your superpowers. It's much easier to take on a second or third cause, both personally and systematically, once you have implemented one change and seen success. The same principle of doing one thing well can apply to consumer decisions, such as committing to alternative transportation or installing solar panels in your home. Do that one thing well, then realize the crucial shift happens when others witness your concern, decisions, and behavior change. The real power comes in your role modeling, your social signaling to everyone around you, Lazarowitz says. When you drive an electric car, you're socializing it. Everywhere you go, you're signaling to people that these things exist. This is about shifting the daily narrative towards the climate. Lazarowitz says this requires opening and talking often about the environment with others in your life. As a parallel, consider the public opinion on smoking indoors just 30 years ago. How would you respond today to someone lighting a cigarette in your house or car without asking? Lazarowitz says the culture at large needs to embrace a similar attitude about pollution. These important conversations about climate can play out naturally and casually in your personal life, but they should also involve joining climate organizations. If you don't have the time to volunteer and show up, Lazarowitz says to donate to local groups that are organizing in your community and applying pressure to lawmakers. Better yet, do both. People often overlook the weight their own neighborhood, city, county, and state carries on the environment. To address this, we must maintain connection with our immediate community, says David Wildcat, a Yuchi member of the Muscogee Nation and professor at Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas. We need to be publicly engaged in that demographic process and public life, says Wildcat, who holds an interdisciplinary PhD in social sciences and public policy. The concept stems from being connected to the land and all that we share with it. Indigenous peoples' cultures were born out of this symbiotic relationship with a place, Wildcat says. The land determined the kind of food they ate, the kind of home they lived in, and the kind of clothes they wear. Some people today think local on food purchases or art, such as shopping at farmers markets and artist fairs. The same should apply to the democratic process. Local policies determine building codes, infrastructure for alternative transportation, public energy consumption, and land use, Wildcat says. Most of these matters are dictated by locally elected officials and public input, where you as a resident and voter have considerable influence. Lazarowitz underscores the roles of mayors as well as the U.S. president. Vote for climate champions at every level of government, he says. It's one of the single most powerful acts you can take. The experts also highlight how the adverse and immediate impact of climate change tends to hit the most vulnerable countries and communities first. So even if you're not yet suffering the effects, your neighbors might be, and so will generations to follow. The effects disproportionately affect Black communities and other communities of color in the U.S., and low-income communities here and around the world, Schlossberg says. Wallace Wells directs anyone who is interested in preventing famines, economic collapse, and unprecedented refugee crises to orient their worldview and politics around climate concerns. Every aspect of human experience has some kind of climate change fingerprint, he says. No matter what you care about, if you really want to solve that problem, thinking about it through a climate lens is critical. Wildcat says this is not a new idea, but one that many people have forgotten. His book, Red Alert, shares how indigenous knowledge could inform how we save the planet today on both a personal and systematic level. He proposes that the term natural resources drives overconsumption, inequality, and imbalance in the natural world. Instead, he teaches a kin-centric worldview in light of the Anthropocene, our current geological age, defined by humans being the dominant force on Earth. Viewing land as kin, he says, generates respect and sustainability, where humans are more open to learn from the natural world rather than dominate it. I don't think there's anything romantic about that. It fits very nicely with evolutionary theory and the science of ecology, Wildcat says. With rights comes inalienable responsibility. Now we start thinking of our relationships in the ecosystem in which we function as part of a moral and ethical universe. Put another way, what's downstream from you, and how are you honoring that life? Schlossberg also named responsibility when asked how humans should manage the existential crisis before them. I don't think people should feel individually guilty for climate change, she says, but we should all feel collectively responsible for building a better world. George Surratt's Sky. Did optical effects from volcanic aerosols inspire the artist's new direction? To artists inspired by what they see in nature, volcanic sunsets are the holy grail of light and color. They transform placid sunsets and post-twilight glows into vibrant bloodbaths of spectral radiance. Yet I'm not writing this to hang on the wall another volcanically inspired sunset painting for us to ponder. Rather, I want to introduce to observers a subtle and little-known daytime phenomenon linked to volcanic activity. It may have, in part, inspired 19th-century post-impressionist French artist Georges Seurat, born 1859, died 1891, in his attempt to reform Impressionism and illuminate the world with a new form of art, his own version of optical blending of color called pointillism. A number of 19th-century artists recreated volcanic sunsets in their paintings. Most touted are the works of English landscape pioneer William Turner, who spent a year painting the vibrant sunsets induced by the weather-altering 1815 eruption of Indonesia's Mount Tambora, the most powerful volcanic event in recorded history. William Ashcroft of Chelsea, London, captured what are arguably the most faithful representations of sunset skies infused with aerosols from the 1883 eruption of Krakatau, a.k.a. Krakatoa, also in Indonesia. He made more than 500 crayon sketches of the changing hues, several of which appear as the frontispiece of the 1888 Royal Society publication, The Eruption of Krakatoa and Subsequent Phenomena. And in 2004, Don Olsen of Texas State University added Norwegian artist Edvard Munch's The Scream to the tally of paintings inspired by the sunsets observed in the 3 years following Krakatoa's historic blast. These artists may not have been alone. In a 2014 paper of the scientific journal Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics, Christos Zephyros of the Academy of Athens in Greece tells how he and his team analyzed red-green ratios in more than 500 paintings from 181 artists, dating from between 1500 and 1900. They recognized the effects of volcanic aerosols, namely a preponderance of warm hues, in sunset paintings created within a period of 3 years that followed each of the 54 major volcanic events during that time period. These include works by Turner, John Singleton Copley, Edgar Degas, and Gustav Klimt. The findings are not surprising, but topping the list is Seurat. Born in Paris to a wealthy family, Seurat studied drawing at night school before he entered the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris in 1878. During his 2 year stay, he became disillusioned with the academic style of painting. The pedantic use of hidden brushstrokes and licked finishes to smooth the surface of a painting. At the same time, he was growing enamored of the large, separate brushstrokes in French Romantic artist Eugène Delacroix's murals and the radical new styles of Impressionist painters Claude Monet, Camille Pissarro, and others. Their use of visible brushstrokes and experimental application of color, tone, and texture worked together to create a vibrant visual impression of a fleeting moment in life. More than an artist, Seurat had a keen aptitude for science. He spent hours scouring libraries for books on optics, scientific theories of color, and principles of design. Specifically, he was keen on the visual effects of contemporary colors and the science behind color perception. He probably learned about those subjects in Principles of Harmony and Contrast of Colors and Their Applications to the Arts, a book written in 1835 by French chemist Michel-Eugène Chevreul. Seurat left the academy in 1879 to spend a year of military service in Brest, where, according to biographer Daniel Catton Rich, he opened his eyes to the luminous effects of sky and quiet water. He then returned to Paris, where he began to apply his evolving principles of composition and color. In his quest to discover a new approach to painting, Seurat turned to science, including Chevreul's law of simultaneous contrast, how one color can change our perception of another color right next to it. Turning away from mixing paint on his palette, he ultimately began applying thousands of small dots of pure color in broken strokes, or small touches set it side by side, directly to the canvas in a precise manner, so that the eye mixed the colors instead. His ever-evolving works achieved such an intensity of light that he believed he had discovered the science of painting. Seurat had not perfected his pointillist technique when he painted his first large-scale composition, Bathers et Assignières. Finished in 1884, it only flirted with his still-evolving pointillist style. Still, one can see in the sky the smoggy effects of air pollution from the industrial chimneys in the distance, giving testament to his pursuit of capturing realistic atmospheric optical effects. A turning point came in the summer of 1881, when Seurat showed the work at the first exhibition of the Group of Independent Artists, of which he was a founding member. That summer, he met with younger neo-impressionist artist Paul Signac, who pointed out to Seurat that Bathers lacked the luminosity of other impressionist paintings, the result of his use of muddy earth tones rather than colors of prismatic purity. As Catton Rich notes in his 1958 book, Seurat, Paintings and Drawings, Seurat's next monumental work, A Sunday Afternoon on the Island of the Grand Jetée, 1884, explores to the fullest the new laws and principles which he and Signac were developing. Seurat preferred to call this new technique color luminism, or chromoluminarism, because it gives a painting not only a greater sense of vibrancy, but also a shimmering effect, like one experiences on a hot summer's day as heat rises from a roadway or sidewalk. Seurat's use of the technique of chromoluminarism coincided with the optical effects trailing the August 1883 eruption of Krakatoa. It seems almost impossible that Seurat and his fellow optical science-oriented artists of the Neo-Impressionist movement would have ignored the profound post-Krakatoa skies, especially because the resulting atmospheric optical effects created the most chromatically vibrant skies recorded for a century. And the vibrancy of light was key to the new artistic movement. But the Krakatoa aerosols also performed light magic in the daytime sky, generating diffuse aerials of contemporary light that radiated most effectively at high noon. Such a sight would have had the capacity to inspire Seurat, especially considering that the artist was keen on the science of diffraction and Rayleigh scattering. It would also be appropriate to suggest the daytime sky, as painted by the Krakatoa eruption, stood before neo-impressionists like a visual muse, inspiring new insights into color and tone that perhaps only science-inspired artists could fully appreciate. X-ray imagining of Bathers et Assignères reveals that Seurat modified parts of it in the mid-1880s, adding prismatic colors in a pointless matter that creates more vibrant feel. Bathers had not quite been complimented by the time Krakatoa erupted in August 1883, and the volcano's associated atmospheric effects only became vividly pronounced over Europe by November of that year. But its optical effects remained intense, at least until 1887, and sky watchers continued to record volcanic atmospheric effects to a lesser degree into the early 1900s. Volcanic skies, then, were present throughout the brief heyday of the French Neo-Impressionist movement, which flourished principally from 1886 to 1906. To understand how these optically vibrant skies may have affected Neo-Impressionist thinking, let's fast forward 100 years to 1982, the year El Chichon erupted in Mexico. On March 28, 1982, El Chichon, a dormant volcano in Chiapas, Mexico, awoke from 600 years of slumber, erupting violently three times a week. One of the most important volcanic events of the 20th century, the unexpected blast released 7.5 million metric tons of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere, warming it by 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit and cooling the northern hemisphere by 0.72 degrees Fahrenheit. The resultant cloud encircled the globe in 20 days and altered Earth's climate for years afterward. The stratospheric aerosol cloud initially moved from southern Mexico towards Hawaii, where I was living at the time. And in 1983 Applied Optics paper, Kinzel L. Coulson notes that a considerable enhancement of intensity occurred throughout the main part of the day, causing a diffuse type of aureole over a large portion of the sky. Mauna Loa Observatory LIDAR measurements over Hawaii in 1982 revealed a six-fold increase in scattering due to aerosols and a 25% decrease in direct incident radiation. In my studies of the El Chichon and Fluis daytime sky, I noticed it had a nervous quality caused by the interplay of minute flecks of contemporary colors. This is why I refer to it in my Hawaiian diaries as an impressionist sky. To a casual viewer, the El Chichon aerosols had buffed away the normally crystal blue sky and replaced it with a frost glass glare of pointless light. Light predominantly infused with flecks of blue and orange, with dabs of yellow and white, that scintillated with subtle prismatic effects like tossed confetti. This description is reminiscent of one recorded 1 month after the Krakatoa paroxysm by Captain Parson of the Irnak, who noticed the eastern sky before sunrise appeared, silver gray, changing to light blue, flecked with numerous small cirrus trimming, pink and rosy. Some of the color associated with the aerosol umbrella I witnessed was linked to the Bishop's Ring atmospheric phenomenon. This enormous diffraction corona, in this case created by the scattering effects of volcanic aerosols, covered half of the visible sky and displayed the color contrast aerosols described by Chevreul, though in the opposite order, namely an enormous blue sphere of light surrounded by a vast orange aureole. The volcanic sky seemed to announce the general rule of neo-impressionism: more opposition, more brilliance. One painting by Seurat moves me because it recalls the flecked complexity of the El Chichon sky. The Eiffel Tower, a montage of predominantly blue, red, and yellow points of color, painted from a vantage point that looked to the southeast across the Seine, where such atmospheric optical effects would be expected. Seurat unveiled this painting in 1889. He began working on it around February 1887 before finalizing the painting in his studio just months ahead of the tower's completion in 1889. During this period, the Bishop's Ring and other aerosol effects were still present in the atmosphere. As T.W. Blackhouse reports in a March 1888 issue of Nature, "I'm informed by Miss E. Brown of Chichester that she saw Bishop's Ring in full daytime as recently as last month, not far from 12 o'clock one day." Adding to the lingering effects of the Krakatoa aerosols were aerosols injected into the atmosphere by the 1886 eruption of Mount Tarawera in New Zealand and the 1888 eruption of Mount Bandai in Japan. So it's possible that volcanic aerosols from three different eruptions contributed to the atmospheric effects we see in the Eiffel Tower, whose pointless style is more boldly laid down than any previous work by Seurat. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodkey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.